Shabbos Daf Kuf Chav Hey. We are beginning 5 lines from the bottom of the Amud on Kuf Chav Dalamud Beis with the words Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Here in the 17th parak of Masechet Shabbos, we are dealing with the topic of Muksa. From the beginning of this parak, we went through an assortment of different cases in which the Chachamim laid down the Gzera that one is not allowed to move these items. The reason why the Chachamim made the Gzera of Muksa is never clearly articulated throughout the Gemara. Yesterday's daf, we were given the only real clue in the Gemara in terms of why the Chachamim made such a Gzera of Muksa. The Gemara associates Muksa with the idea of Hotzah, that the more items that we move around, the more tempted we are, you're going to pick up the item and transfer them from Rishus HaRabim to Rishus HaYachid, or from Rishus HaYachid to Rishus HaRabim. In fact, the Ravid brings down this as one of the reasons for Muksa. But the Rishonim give other reasons in terms of why the Chachamim were gozer on Muksa. But basically, the idea is, as the Rambam articulates this very clearly, is that we want Shabbos to look different than the rest of the week, and therefore those items that do not serve purposes on Shabbos, the Chachamim made this Gzera of Muksa. As we already learned also earlier in this parak, Muksa went through a bit of an evolution. When originally instituted by the Navi Nehemiah, the Muksa Gzera extended to almost every utensil out there. And then what happened is that they scaled back on the Gzera of Muksa over course of time. There were eventually 4 repeals on Muksa, so that Muksa, instead of being very large and general, turned into a much more condensed condensed version of what it is. Exactly what does Muksa entail? So we saw also this yesterday in the Gemara. It's a basic machlokas tanaim, exactly where we landed in terms of the parameters of scope of Muksa. In speaking about this in a very basic terms, we have 3 sheets amongst the tanaim. We have Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Nechemia in that order. Rabbi Shimon leisay muksa. Rabbi Shimon has the smallest scope of what is entailed in muksa. The way the Gemara says is that Rabbi Shimon simply does not hold the muksa. But as we've learned, and we're going to continue repeating, that does not mean that Rabbi Shimon has no concept of muksa. It means that his category of muksa is extraordinarily limited. Muksa machmas chisar and kis is basically the purview of what Rabbi Shimon categorizes as muksa. But outside of that, Rabbi Shimon does not subscribe to muksa. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda islay muksa. Rabbi Yehuda does hold to the concept of muksa and has a much larger window of what falls under the category of muksa. And then Rabbi Nechemiah is even more machmir. Rabbi Nechemiah says that those items on Shabbos, even if they're not muksa, but they can only be used for the primary purpose, and you cannot go ahead and use an item for something that it is not primarily serving. It's not what it is normally utilized as. So those are the sheetahs amongst the tanaim. We also went through in this parak machlokas Abaye and Rava, even when they scale back a muksa. So what did they allow for muksa items? For those things which are klisha malachto le'isser. So what can you do with a klisha malachto le'isser? According to Rava, you can move it tzarech gufo and tzarech mekama. You cannot move it mecham le'tzel. And we learned that according to Abaye, you can move it only tzarech gufo, but you cannot even move it le'tzarech mekama, and certainly not mecham le'tzel. Again, all this is just a very brief review of the topics of muksa that we covered and some of the larger ideas. In yesterday's daf, we talked about shivrei muksa. What happens when an item breaks? So we discussed briefly yesterday, did it break before Shabbos? Did it break after? Did it break on the Shabbos? There might be a difference between them. This was part of yesterday's discussion. And basically, what can we do with the shvarim? What can we do with these broken pieces? So as long as the broken pieces have utility, so then you are, in fact, allowed to move them on Shabbos. In this discussion, we saw in the Mishnah yesterday, on Kuf Chav Dalamud Beis, and Machlokas Tanaim, between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. In the Mishnah, Rabbi Meir's name is not mentioned, but the Tanakama Shita is presumed to be the Shita of Rabbi Meir, and we're going to see that a little bit later on. Rabbi Meir says that in order for Shivrei Kelim to be moved on Shabbos, it has to serve a utility. It does not need to have the same utility that it had when it was part of the larger Kli, but as long as it serves a utility, that would be sufficient. That is what he described as Ke'en Malacha. On the other hand, Shitas Rabbi Yehuda is that the only way that the Shvarim are going to be able to be used on Shabbos is it's only Me'ein Malachtan. It must be able to serve the same utility as the original piece. We saw this machlokas in the Mishnah between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. They gave examples. Go back to the Mishnah, review the Mishnah in terms of the examples that were given. That was the machlokas we saw regarding Shivrei Kelim. In that vein, we're now continuing in the Gemara. We're on 5 lines from the bottom. The Amud, Amr Rabbi Yehuda, Amr Shmuel, Megufas Chavis. So let's say you have the lid of a barrel, shenichtata. The barrel itself broke. So now the lid no longer, the lid is fine, the lid's still in good shape, but it no longer has the barrel to serve. So mutal atalta b'Shabbos, the lid still has utility on Shabbos, and one is still allowed to move the lid on Shabbos. Tanya Mihaka, the Gemara is going to bring a brisa supporting the statement of Rabbi Yehuda Mishmuel, Megufa Shenichteta. So if you have the barrel, the lid of the barrel, well, the barrel broke, he v'shivra mutal atalta b'Shabbos. You're allowed to move the lid on Shabbos, you're allowed to move the pieces on Shabbos. Now, as far as the shvarmer is concerned, as far as the pieces are concerned, so you can't round them out. You can't smooth them out. You can't round them out. You want to use them. You want to repurpose them. You want to put them under a kli. You want to put them under the legs of a bed in order to stabilize the bed. That's fine, but you can't smooth them out. V'im zarka, Rashi, by the way, points out over here, if you do smooth them out, you'll be in violation of makeh bepatish. V'im zarka ba'ashba yasser aser. Now, if you take the lid, right, Rashi says we're going back to the lid over here. If you take the lid and you throw the lid in the garbage, so at that point in time, it's going to be aser. So Rashi says that you were mevatel from Taurus Kli. It no longer has the category of a Kli. Maskevla Rapapa. So Rapapa says, I have a hard time understanding this last point of the Braisa. Elamiata zarkli leglima hachinami daser. So you throw away a good shirt. Right, Rashi says we're talking about anchapis. You throw away a good shirt. So you want to tell me now that this shirt is going to lose its status of being a kli? I don't understand. Just because a person does not find the value in an item, but if the item is still a functional item, it still has this utility, so then it should still remain the status of a kli, and it should not lose its designation of muksa. So I don't understand. If the lid is still in perfect condition and I happen to have thrown it away, why should it lose the status of muksa? That wouldn't be true if I threw a shirt away. So Elam Rapapa, so Rapapa coming to explain this says, as we now turn to the top of Kuf Chav Hei Amud Aleph, Im Zarka Mi Ba'od Yom La'ash Ba'asur. We're not talking about throwing it away on Shabbos. Say Nachinami. If going into Shabbos it has the status of a Kli, then just because the person discards it does not make it lose its status of being a Kli. We're talking about where you threw it away before Shabbos. Rashi writes over here, Gali Daite Me'esmo De'Lav Manahu. Because now he has shown clearly with his actions that this is not a kli. Look, it's a lid that doesn't have any longer a barrel to cover. The barrel broke. And if you're throwing the lid away before Shabbos, that is a clear demonstration that you no longer have a need for this kli. And at that point in time, you can actually cause it to lose its status. That's what the Bryce is making reference to. And under those circumstances, the lid is in fact going to lose its status of being a kli. Continuing on the top of Kuf Chav Hei Amud Aleph, Amar Bar Hamduri Amar Shmuel Krumi Yosho Machatzelis Mutal Atalton V'Shabbos. So let's say you have some of the fraying of a mat. So you have a mat and some of the ends fray off. So those frayed pieces can be used on Shabbos, can be moved on Shabbos. Now obviously in order for it to be moved on Shabbos, that means it must have a purpose. What is the purpose of these items? My Taima, Amar Rava Bar Hamduri Azbali. It was explained to me, Machatzelis Gufa Lamaychazi. Well, let's think about it. What are you going to do with the mat itself? So lichasui be'afra. So you take the mat and you put it over dirt. So hanina mechazin lichasui be'tinofis. So the same thing you're going to do with the frayed pieces. These small frayed pieces you're going to put on something that is unpleasant. Rashi over here gives an example. Let's say there's so on the ground, there's excrement on the ground, or maybe you just simply don't want the dust to come up off the ground. So you take these frayed pieces, you put it on the ground. Meaning these frayed pieces will have the same utility as the mat itself. Just like the mat is not muksa, so too the frayed pieces are not going to be muksa as well. I'm Rabbi Zera, I'm Rav Shayari, Pruzmios, Asul Atalton B'Shabbos. If I have small pieces of a talus that get frayed from the talus, so they cannot be moved on Shabbos. I'm Rabbi, Ben Matlan Yoshein Bahim Gimel Gimel. So when we're talking about these pieces of a talus that fell off and it no longer has a purpose, so we're talking about really small pieces. They don't even have the area coverage of 3x3 etzbaos, 3x3 inches approximately. The lo chazim, lo lanim, lo lashirim. It's not going to be used by anybody, not by a wealthy person, and not even by a poor person. So since these items are so small and they don't have any utility to them, so therefore they are in fact going to lose its status of being a kli, and it's not going to be useful at all. Tosus points out over here, we're just going to go back for a moment to this halacha of Shmuel, that the frayed pieces of the mat are considered non-muksa because they serve the same purpose. Now, isn't the Gemara now making a decision on the machlokas that we saw in the Mishnah? Meaning in the Mishnah, we talked about shivrei kelim. Shivrei kelim are not going to be muksa, assuming that they have a utility. Now, in the Mishnah, we had a machlokas. We went over it at the beginning of Shir. a machlokus between Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda. According to Rav Meir, it just simply has to have a utility. According to Rav Yehuda, it has to have the same utility as the item it broke off from. Is the Gemara over here clearly stating, articulating a position like Rav Yehuda and not like Rav Meir? So Tosfos says not necessarily. When the Gemara gives us an example, when it comes to the frayed matting, so the Gemara's example over here, Tosfos' language is l'ravcha demilsa. It's just simply the Gemara wants to cover all of its bases, meaning the Gemara doesn't want to get involved in the machlokas, and that's why the Gemara gives an example where I'm using the frayed pieces for the same purpose that I would use the actual mat itself. Only because the Gemara wanted to incorporate the position of Rav Yehuda, but not because the Gemara is deciding the halakha like Rav Yehuda. It's just simply to cover all of our bases. Anyway, continuing in the Gemara Tanur Rabbanan. So more on the topic of Shivrei Kelim. Here we talk about Shivrei Tanur. You have an oven which is broken. Just a brief introduction to ovens. We discussed ovens extensively back in the third parak of the Masechet. And now we're going to come back to the topic of ovens, but in our context of Muksa and the oven broke. So let's just, a couple of words about an oven. Their ovens were very simplistic. Their ovens were basically a cardboard box, not made out of cardboard, I'm just giving a shape. So it basically looked like a cardboard box. Now the oven, the tanur in question over here, generally had the walls inclining inward, so that basically as you stoked, you put the coals on the bottom of this oven, and now because of the incline, and because now it narrows as it gets to the top, so it's going to capture a lot more of the heat. And then what you do is you're going to put the food in the oven. You're actually going to take the bread and put it on the interior walls of the oven in order to bake the bread. Maybe there were grates over there and you put the food, and maybe you put meat on the grates. Whatever the case is that this is basically the layout of their oven. Their ovens were made out of earthenware. I think we covered that already. And now what we're going to be discussing is what would be the halachic status of the oven pieces, meaning the oven broke, presumably on Shabbos. And now what's going to be the status of these oven pieces? So Shivrei Tanur Yashan. So Shitas Rav Meir is that if I have broken pieces of an oven, so they're going to have the same status as a kli, and they can be moved on Shabbos. Meaning just like the kalim, just like the oven itself can be moved on Shabbos. Now, in of itself, by the way, the oven is a kli. At the same time, it is a kli shemachta le'iser, right? Obviously, the oven is meant for cooking. So what you would be able to move it for is tzarech gufo, tzarech makomo. Okay, I'd have to be a little bit creative in terms of coming up with a case of tzarech gufo, but tzarech makomo, I need the area where the oven is right now, so therefore I can move the oven. So anyway, similarly, when we're talking about the shivrei tanur, the broken pieces of the tanur, so presumably we mean to say that just like the oven itself is a kli, so too the shvarim, the pieces also have the status of being a kli, and therefore are not muksa. Rav Yehuda Omer, eini talmid. Rav Yehuda is of the opinion that those pieces of the oven cannot be moved. The machlokus is going to be explained on the Amud Aleph of today's daf. Hey, Rav Yosi, Mishum, Rav Elazar ben Yaakov. And then, on a side note, but related to ovens, so it was testified by Rav Yosi in the name of Rav Elazar ben Yaakov, Ashevei Tanu Yashen Shini Talam B'Shabbos, so that the broken pieces of an oven can be moved on Shabbos. That's halacha number one that he's testifying about, meaning, and that is in accordance with the Shita of Rav Meir, and Al-Kisiyav Shein Etzarech Beis Yad, and on top of that, the lids of the oven do not need to have a handle, meaning the lids of an oven can be moved, even if it does not have a handle fashion to it. We're going to come back to that at the end of our first Amud of today's daf. But in the meantime, however, so we have a machlokes between Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda, and now for the remainder of Amud Aleph, we're going to try to explain the machlokes between Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda. An oven that breaks and the pieces of the oven are muksa or not muksa, so this is a machlokes. Rav Meir says the pieces are not muksa, Rav Yehuda says the pieces are muksa, and so what the Gemara is going to try to do now is give a hesber in the machlokes by Mikah Miflagi. What are they arguing about? Amar Abaye. So the Gemara is going to go over three different possibilities to explain the machlokas between Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda, and this is going to be round one. Abaye says, "Bosin mei malach vein osin mei malachtan kemiflegi." So Abaye gives what seems to be a very straightforward explanation based on what we learned back in the Mishnah. In the Mishnah, we learned that there's a machlokas in terms of shvarim, the broken pieces, if in fact they're going to remain in a status of muchan, of not muksa. So do they have to have utility? The answer is yes. What kind of utility do they have? So that's the machlokas that we've already went through. Rav Meir says that they simply have to have a utility, and Rav Yehuda says they have to have its original utility. So we learned that back in the Mishnah, and the Gemara says this is a wonderful way to explain the machlokas here in this braisa regarding the broken pieces of the oven. And Abaye says, Vazda Rav Yehuda Tameh, Rav Meir Tameh. And Rav Yehuda is being consistent with his position, Rav Meir is being consistent with his position, and it seems to be a wonderful way to explain the machlokas. So Maskel Rava. So Rava says, "Ihachi ad mifligei b'shivrei tanur, liflegei b'shivrei kelim al ba'alma." So Rava says to Abaye, "Look, it is a nice way to explain the machlokas, but let me ask you a simple question. In the Braisa that we just went through, so it says Shivrei Tanur, the broken pieces of an oven. If this is just the basic machlokus of Rameir and Rabbi Yehuda regarding whether the Shvarim have to have a utility or the original utility, so why is the Braisa here arguing about an oven? Meaning this is a much broader debate. This is a debate regarding Kalim in general. And so for the Braisa to say this is going to be a machlokus specific to broken pieces of an oven, so the explanation would seem to have to be specific to an oven and not just the general discussion that we had back in the Mishnah. So what Rava's argument is, his opposition is that if Abai was right, so just simply say Shivrei Kalim. Why is the Braisa talking about Shivrei Tanur? So Elam Rava, so Rava says, I'm going to give a much more detailed explanation of what they're arguing about, and it's going to get very detailed. B'Shivrei Dahai Tanur Kamiflgi. They're arguing about an oven, and not just an oven, but a very specific oven, an oven that's mentioned in the Mishnayos in Kalim. So here we go to a Mishnah in Kalim in the fifth parak, where the Mishnah in Kalim is going to bring down the following debate. Did not. Nasno al piyabur al piyadu. So let's say you take an oven, you put it over a pit or over a pit. Now, a bor and a dut are both different types of pit. A bor happens to be a hole dug into the ground. A dut is built into a structure, into like a some sort of housing structure. Either way, it basically you're going into the ground and you're putting the oven into the ground. Now, in order to understand this, so let's just, again, let's take a step backwards. Let's talk about their ovens back in the day. So the ovens back in the day, as we already pointed out, was basically a cardboard box where the walls went, the walls tilted inward. But again, I say cardboard, I'm just giving the shape. It's really made out of earthenware. And then what happens is that basically you solidify to the ground and you put it into the ground. As we're going to learn in just a moment, if the oven becomes tamei, so then the halacha is, we're going to see the pasuk in just a moment, the Torah says that the only way to resolve its tumah is only yutats. What you have to do is you have to totally deconstruct it. In other words, you have to break it into pieces, right? Similar to a kli cheres, meaning it's not just similar, it is a kli cheres, but because the Torah gives us clear instructions regarding an oven of yutats, so that means to say that it was something that was fixed into the ground, and yutats means that it has to be deconstructed, it has to be taken out of the ground, uprooted from the ground. And so what we're discussing right now over here is basically the definition of an oven. So the definition of an oven means that it has to be the kind of oven where the heating is occurring in the oven itself. What we're going to be discussing here in this Mishnah and Kalim is something extraordinarily specific where I'm basically putting the oven in a hole in the ground, but the hole is larger than the oven, significantly larger than the oven. And what we're going to do in order to get the oven to fit into the ground is basically we're going to put in a couple of reinforcers external to the oven that basically are going to clog the oven right up against the walls of the ground. And so these rocks are there to just basically be able to force this oven to fit in the ground. It's not going to go all the way to the bottom of the pit. There's going to be airspace between the bottom of the pit and the base of the oven. Now, the debate, we're going to see this all in the Mishnah in just a moment, but it's going to be a little bit easier if I go over this as outside first. Now what we're going to be doing is that we're going to be laying the heat source. We're not going to put the heat source on the bottom of the oven wall, but rather we're going to put the heat source on the bottom of the pit. And now what the heat is going to do is the heat's going to rise, obviously, and it's going to heat up the oven. But because there are obviously exhaust to go between the oven wall and the pit, remember this particular pit is a little bit wider than the oven, so that means to say that a lot of the heat now is going to escape through the sides and it's not going to hit the bottom of the wall of the oven. And the question that's going to be dealt with over here in this Mishnah in Kalim is, does this oven have the status of being an oven? Is it legally considered an oven? So that is going to be the discussion, the debate taking place in the Mishnah. After we see the discussion, what Rav is then going to do is it's going to relate it to our machlokas in our Braisa, the machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and Rameir about broken pieces of an oven. Let's see the Mishnah inside. Nasno api abora api adus. So let's say you put the oven in a pit, right? Either it's in a hole in the ground or it's a hole in the house. Either way, v'nasan sham evan. Now you put a stone over there. As I explained, again, everything I'm saying I got from Rashi. As I explained, so the rocks are there just simply so that now you can really jam the oven so that the oven doesn't go all the way down to the bottom of the ground. But basically, the oven is suspended a little bit from the bottom of the pit with these rocks. Now, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Imasik Malamata, Hu Nisak Malamala, Tamei, Vim Lav Tahor. So So Rabbi Huda says as follows. Let's say the amount of exhaust that is allowing the heat to escape between the area of the oven and the side of the pit, if it's so extensive that the oven really doesn't get heated up with this fire that is made on the bottom of the pit, this oven does not qualify as an oven. I'll read the words inside. If I'm creating a heat source on the bottom, meaning at the floor of the pit, and the oven does in fact get hot, meaning that there's not a lot of air, there's not a lot of exhaust, there's not a lot of heat escaping on the sides, and the vast majority of the heat is actually hitting the floor of the oven, actually heating up the oven, tummy, then the oven is tummy, meaning it's susceptible to tumma, meaning it has the status of being an oven. The imlav tahor, however, if there's so much air that's escaping, if there's so much heat that's escaping through the sides, this oven does not qualify as an oven. That is Shitas Rav Yehuda. The Chachamim Omrim hold v'husak mikomakom tameh. And the Chachamim say no, even though it's true that some of the heat is escaping from the sides, but if as long as the oven does get hot to a certain degree, so it qualifies as an oven, and it's going to be tameh. So this is a machlokas between Rav Yehuda and the Chachamim regarding the very definition of an oven. Now, Now the Gemara, as long as quoting this Mishnah in Kalim, so the Gemara would like a better understanding of what this machlokas is predicated on. By Ikra, they're arguing about the following. We go to the pasuk in the Torah that describes an oven and its status of becoming tane. Taner v'karam yitatz tameim heim u'tameim yulachem. So you have an oven, a taner ikiraim. Taner is the oven we've been describing. Kiraim, also an oven, a little bit different in shape. It's more rectangular. It doesn't have the walls going inside. We discussed this back in the third perek. Anyway, it's another type of an oven. Taner v'kiraim yutatz. So the Torah says that as far as the oven is concerned, if it becomes tameh, so you must break it. Break it apart. Tameim heim, they are tameh. U'tameim yulachem, and they're going to be tameh. Now over here, even though it's one pasuk and it's one phrase, but you already see that there is a certain superfluous nature to the pasuk, where the Torah describes it as being tameh and being tameh. So Rav Yehuda Savar Mechus and Atitza Tameh Shein Mechus and Atitza Tahor. So Rav Yehuda says, okay, so what we're learning here in this pasuk is not just that the oven, if it becomes tameh, needs to be broken, but we're learning what the definition of an oven is. And that is, the definition of an oven is an oven where it's the oven is being totally heated up by the heat source. If the oven is not totally being heated up by the heat source, it's not going to be an oven. And so if you have this kind of oven setup that we described, where there is room between the walls of the oven and the side of the pit, where there's a lot of heat of escaping, so this is not going to be considered an oven. This doesn't qualify as an oven, and therefore it's going to be tahor. V'rabbanan savre, and the chachamim say, mitameim yulachem ikom akom. No, they look at the end of the pasuk, the fact that there's a ribui, there's extra words at the end of the pasuk, so they take that to understand as a chumrah, meaning, you're right, Rabbi Yehuda, that your understanding of the definition of an oven is a good definition. But then when the Torah goes ahead and says, v'tameim yulachem, what the Torah is doing is it's giving us a ribu, it's giving us an additional definition. The Torah is being machmer, not being mekel, that's the way Rashi describes it. And so therefore that means to say that even if the oven is not being totally heated up by the heat source underneath, and even though there is a heat escaping on the sides, as long as the oven gets heated up by the heat source, even to a lesser degree, it's still going to be an oven, it's still going to be subject to becoming tameh. So that is the machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir. Now the Gemara over here is just going to go a little bit back and forth. V'rabbanan nami aksiv yutatz. Now according to the Chachamim, the Torah does say the word yutatz, which gives us for Rabbi Yehuda the definition of an oven. An oven is only to be broken if it is going to be heated to the full degree by the heat source. What's the Chachamim going to do with that pasuk? Hahu li'idach yisa. So the Chachamim understand this to go in the other direction. Sakadat chamina kevin dechavre ba'ara kugufa da'ara dami. Because look, I might have thought that if the oven is so secured in the ground, meaning that there's literally no space between the oven and the walls of the ground, so one could have argued that this oven now is considered part and parcel of the ground. And we know that anything that's mechubel karka, anything connected to the ground, is not mekabel tuma. So I could have made the argument and said that if this oven is so secured in the ground, so therefore it's not going to be tame because it's considered mechubel karka. So the yutatz is coming to tell me that no, that it's still going to have the status of being an oven, it's still going to be subject to being mekabel tuma. So kamash malan, that's what the Yutat is coming to teach us. V'idach, now what is Rabbi Yehuda going to do with the end of the pasuk? Nami haksiv tamei miulachem. So he could Rabbi Yehuda Meshmuel. So for that, Rabbi Yehuda will tell us that it goes with the halacha of Rabbi Yehuda Meshmuel. Now I'm Rabbi Yehuda Meshmuel. Machlokus behesek rishon. It's true that we have a debate. Me and the Chachamim are debating, but that's only the first time the oven is heated up. Avah behesek sheni. But once the oven has already been heated up, in the way that Rabbi Yehuda says that an oven works, meaning that it is fully heated up from its interior. Now that the oven has the status of being an oven, so that's it. Once the oven has the status of being an oven, the next time you light up the oven, it could be lit in this indirect manner. But, and it's still going to be subject to being tamed. Afilu talu b'tzav gamal. And even if the oven is hanging suspended off the neck of a camel, it's a funny way to describe it, but it just simply means that even if the oven is now suspended in air and the heat source is below it, and yes, the heat is going to come up and it's going to heat up the oven, but there's so much open air now that most of the heat is going to escape and most of the heat is not going to hit the bottom of the oven. It's not going to go into the interior of the oven. Still, as long as this is hesek sheni, as long as the oven has already been used the first time correctly, so now it has the status of an oven and it doesn't lose the status of an oven. That's what the pasuk is coming to teach me. Amar Ula v'hesek rishon l'rabban afilo tavli b'tzavi gamar. Now Ula just simply highlights the shita of the Chachamim, meaning to what degree do the Chachamim disagree with the Rabbi Yehuda? The Chachamim are so far away from Rabbi Yehuda that even if the oven in the hesek rishon, in the first time that the oven heated was heated up, it's not just simply in the ground and there's a good amount of exhaust that exists between the walls of the oven and the walls of the pit. But even if the oven is above ground, and even if it's hanging off the neck of a camel, even under those circumstances, as long as the heat that's coming from the ground is heating up the oven, the Chachamim would tell you this qualifies as an oven, and therefore it's going to be Mekabel Tumah. So we just see now the extreme positions of Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim in terms of what is the definition of an oven. Now that we have all this information, now we could plug it in. What now is, according to Rava, the explanation of the machlokus between Rabbi and Rabbi Yehuda regarding Shivrei Tanor? So the explanation is based on the following. We are discussing now, well, let's start with our original oven. Is our original oven going to be considered an oven? It depends. According to Rabbi Yehuda, the oven's only going to be an oven under the circumstances where the source of fire is coming interior or it's coming from underneath, but there is no exhaust. So that means to say that the oven is being totally heated up by the fire, and so this qualifies as an oven. If there is exhaust, so then it doesn't qualify as an oven. So that means to say that according to Rabbi Yehuda, if the oven is not being fully heated up by the fire, it doesn't qualify as an oven. It's just simply not an oven. And according to the Chachamim, it does qualify as an oven. And so, if I have the broken shards of said oven, so is that now going to be considered pieces of oven? So according to Rabbi Yehuda, the answer is no, and according to the Chachamim, the answer is going to be yes. So this is now Rava's explanation of the machlokus between Rabbi Yehuda and Rav Meir of our Braisa. Now all this is a very detailed explanation. However, it seems to be that there is a critical piece missing in this explanation. Maskal Ravashi, continuing in the Gemara, Ravashi says, Yahakya demifli b'shivrei tanur liflige b'tanur gufa. Hashta tanur gufa l'Rabbi Yehuda lohave mana shvar mibaye. So wait one second. This explanation was really detailed, but really, at the core of Rava's explanation, we are debating what is considered an oven and what is not considered an oven. So in the Braisa that opened up our entire discussion, we were talking about shivrei tanur. Why is the discussion around shivrei tanur? The discussion should be around a tanur itself. Because according to Rava's explanation, the very debate taking place between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim of that Mishnah and Kalim is talking about the very definition of an oven. And if it's an oven, so therefore it's going to have the status of being a kli. If it's not an oven, it's not going to have the status of being a kli. And so now Rava's explanation is, even before you get to the case, before we get to the broken pieces of the oven, he says that the machlokus really revolves around an actual oven itself. Why in the Brice are we talking about shivrei tanur? We're already removed from what the debate really is resting on. The debate is really going on the actual oven itself. So although he may be right, he is right in terms of understanding Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, that Mishnah and Kalim, but to plug it back here into the Braisa is clearly turning on the fact that the oven is broken. And then we have a machlokes between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, so it really doesn't do a good job explaining our Braisa. So El Amar Ravashi, now this is going to be the third attempt of explaining now the Braisa. El Amar Ravashi, La'olam kedamar mikara. We're going to go back to our original suggestion. Uva Osei Masa Tafka. So what happened over here is you had an oven. And we're assuming right now that the oven, of course, is an oven. It has the status of being a keli. And then they broke on Shabbos. And so now what's the debate? So he says, let's go back to what we originally proposed. The machlokes of Rameir and Rav Yehuda is the same l'shitas of machlokes that we saw back in the Mishnah in yesterday's daf, in terms of whether or not it has to have a utility, the shita of Rameir, or it has to be me'in malachtan, it has to be from its original utility. And so here's what they're debating when it comes to the broken pieces of an oven. And that is that when you have the broken pieces of the oven, so in the very least, what you're looking at right now is that it's true, it's not functioning as an oven, but can't I take each of the tiles that broke off the oven and can't I basically use it almost like a griddle? And can't I cook right on top of it? So Rameir Lidvar of the Rav Yehuda Kamar. So Rameir says to Rav Yehuda, look, let me try to argue this point with using your thought process. Because look, as far as I'm concerned, as long as the pieces have a utility, so I'm comfortable. I'm fine saying now that it is not muksa. And so the broken pieces of an oven have some sort of utility. So for as far as I'm concerned, I don't have to think much about it. But I'm talking now to you, Rabbi Yehuda, and I'm working within your shita. But over here, the broken pieces of an oven should have, according to you, the same status of the oven. Because what do you do with an oven? You cook in it. So if you have now the broken tiles of an oven, so you can also bake in it, cook in it, you could use it like a griddle. Rabbi Yehuda, lo dami, Rabbi Yehuda says, look, my definition of mei malachtan is a very specific definition. Hasam hiskumi bifnim hachlu hiskumi b'chutz. Hasam u'man hachalav ma'uman. Because consider that when I am making something in an oven, so where is the heat generated? Interior to the oven. Now, if the oven broke and now I'm using some of the tiles to cook on the tiles, so where is the heat coming from? So in other words, the heat's going to be on one side and that which you're cooking is going to be on the other side. So the heat is no longer interior, the heat is now exterior. That's one difference. On top of that, when I'm cooking in an oven, the walls of the oven are facing vertically. And now when they break and I'm using it like a griddle, so now the tiles are going to be horizontal. As far as I'm concerned, even though they're cooking, but it's different types of cookings. It's a different type of heat, exterior as opposed to interior. It's a different positioning. It's now horizontal as opposed to vertical. For me, that's enough so it no longer qualifies as me'in malachtan, and therefore I do not think that it would be muchan. I now think that it's muksa. So this is now the final way of presenting the machlokas of Rameir and Rav Yehuda in the Braisa. Going now to the end of the Braisa, Hey, Rav Yosi, Mishim, Rav Elazar ben Yaakov, Al Shivrei Tanu Yashin, Shinitalim v'Shabbos. So there were two edus that were given by Rav Yosi in the name of Rav Elazar ben Yaakov. Number one, the broken pieces of an oven can be moved, like the shita of Rav Meir. And number two, v'akisu of shein tzarech v'esyad. And also, the lid of an oven does not need a handle. Meaning the lid of an oven still has a status of being a kli, even though it doesn't have a handle. Am ravina kamama tatlina ha'idna, kisui de tanuri de masa mechasya de inlan beitz achiza. Ravina asked a question. Nowadays, in the town of Masa Mechasya, everybody moves their lids, the covers of the oven, even though they don't have a handle, and who are they relying on? Come on, for Rav Elazar ben Yaakov. They're relying on the shita of Rav Elazar ben Yaakov. Okay, Adkan. That takes us through the end of our first mission, our first sugya of today's daf. So back on just as a quick recap, we saw the machlokas Rav Yehuda and Rav Meir regarding shivrei kelim, whether they can be moved on Shabbos. The kli broke on Shabbos itself, and can I move the shvarim? So they have to have a utility. What kind of utility? Rav Meir simply says any utility, and Rav Yehuda says it has to have the same utility as it did when it was before it broke. And within that, we saw a braisa that speaks about shivrei tanur. So is this braisa going to be reflective of the Mishnah? Abaye proposes yes, Rav proposes no. And Rav Ashi goes back to Abaye's position and says, yes, that's exactly the point over here. And what we're learning is really a chumr within the sheet of Rav Yehuda, in that even if it's accomplishing the same purpose, but not in the same way, that is not considered kein malachta. Okay, a quick review of the first amud of today's daf. Continuing now on the Mishnah, on the Bam of Kufcha, Pam and Aleph, we now go into other halachas of Muksa. Ha Evan, Shebekiruya, Im Mamalimba, Vein Nofelis Mamalimba, Vim Lav, Im Mamalimba. in order to explain this first case of the Mishnah. So basically what you're doing now is that you're taking the shell of a melon, you took out all the fruit, right, cantaloupe, you took out all the fruit of the cantaloupe, and you're left now with just simply a bowl, right? You cut the melon in half, you took out all the fruit, and you're now left with a shell. So if you want to repurpose the shell, so a great suggestion. And that would be now is that you could basically tie the shell up and put it down into draw it down into the well and pick up water with this with the shell of a melon. And that would be wonderful. The problem is that the shell is very light and it's very buoyant. And so what you want to do is you want to weigh it down. So what you're going to do is you're going to put a stone in the shell in order so that now it goes into the water so that it's able to collect the water. Okay, so now with all that stated, so now we have to put on our halachic lenses and take a look at this from a muksa issue. Now, the stone in and of itself, of course, is muksa. But because now the stone is being incorporated into the shell, so now the stone has a clear function, right? You're making this before Shabbos, obviously. So now the stone is now given a function. It's given a purpose. It's there to weigh down the shell. So now, is the stone going to be considered part and parcel of your shell? So that's what the Mishnah is describing. And the Mishnah basically says is that if the stone is so embedded within the shell of the melon, so now that the melon drops down into the water and you pick it up and the stone is still there, so now it's clearly made part of it, and therefore the shell of the stone in it is not muksa. If, however, the stone were to fall out, so then you cannot use the shell. Now, let's go to Rashi over here on the Mishnah. So, two Rashis I want to highlight in the Mishnah. The first one, imamad limba ve'inu nafelas, if in the first case where you're filling up with the shell with the stone in it, and the stone doesn't fall out, Rashi says, shikshura yafeh, right? You embedded the stone into the melon, you actually tied the stone into the melon, you kind of knotted it into the melon, lefi hakiriya shavya kli. So at this point in time now, basically the stone becomes part and parcel of the kli. It's part of the composition of the kli. Next Rashi, v'imlav hare kishara vanim. However, if the stone was just basically dropped into the melon shell before Shabbos, but it wasn't tied in, so now you have a compound problem. Number one, the stone was not rendered a kli. But on top of that, you're also now with another problem. The ein metaltelness akiriya, you can't even take the shell. Deshavya basis le'evin hasheno sasa, because now what the shell is a basis, it's a base for a davar hamuksa. This is what we discussed already a number of times, a basis a davar ha'asr. When something becomes the base for something that which is muksa on Shabbos, so the base itself now becomes muksa. So if the stone was not embedded, was not tied in, knotted into the shell, and the stone is now just sitting on the shell, so the stone is a muksa, and b, a basis to the shell becomes a basis to that stone, and the shell itself also becomes muksa as well. Next case in the Mishnah, we're on the top of Kuchav Amidbeis, Zmura Sheik Shura B'Tafiach. If let's say you take a vine, and you attach it to a jug, the jug where you're going to be drawing water from the well, so Mamalim Baba Shabbos, so you're allowed to fill it up, even though the vine is an organic piece of material, and it is in general a muksa item, it's not a kli, but once you tie it to the jug before Shabbos, so now you're obviously giving it a purpose. It's basically serving as a rope for the jug, and therefore it's no longer muksa. And finally, the last halach in the Mishnah, the kaka chalon, the shutters of the windows, back in the good old days, if you want to close the windows, so they didn't have glass to close to put over the windows, but rather they just simply had a shutter. That's the pekaka chalon. Rebbe Lazar is manchu kashur v'talui, poking him bow, v'imlav ain poking him bow. Rebbe Lazar is of the opinion that the shutter has to be connected to the side of the house, and also it has to be suspended, meaning to say that the string tying it is so taut that it's just simply hanging there. Under those circumstances, then you can close the shutter on Shabbos, and if not, you can't close the shutter on Shabbos. And the Chachamim are of the opinion that under all circumstances you're allowed to go ahead and put the shutter in. This machlokes between Rav Elazar and the Chachamim is going to be clearly explained in tomorrow's daf. So this halacha we're going to reserve for tomorrow's daf in terms of what exactly the issue is. We are going to be focusing now on the first two halachas of the Mishnah. We start with learning a Mishnah that we will be seeing later on in our Masechta Zanan Hasam. Mishnah later on, Kuf Mem Beis, Evan Shal Pi Achaviz Matal Tzida V'Hino Feles. If let's say you had a stone that was on top of a barrel. I want the contents of the barrel, but there's a stone sitting on top of it. So what you're allowed to do is you're allowed to tip over the barrel, moving the stone, but indirectly, it's Totel Menatzad. And now, once the stone is off the barrel, so you can go ahead now and help yourself to the barrel and the contents therein. That's the Mishnah later on. On this Mishnah now, there are going to be two opinions amongst the Amorim. Amar Rabba, Amar Rabbi Ami, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. So we have our first, which is Rabba saying in the name of Rabba, Ami saying in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. The name we're going to focus on right now in this Mesorah is going to be Rabbi Ami. You'll see why I say that. Lo Shana Lo B'Shocheach. This halacha is only going to be true if I forgot the stone on the barrel, meaning I didn't deliberately put the stone on the barrel, but rather I forgot. As we learned earlier in the Masechta, if something was left on another item, but not intentionally, just in the state of being shocheach, you forgot it there, you just simply left it there, it doesn't take on the halacha of basis. So over here, one could have made the argument that the barrel is a basis of davar ha'aser. So you could have made that argument, but that argument is only true if one intentionally put the stone on top of the barrel. But under these circumstances, the stone was left on the barrel by accident. So therefore, the barrel is not a basis of davar ha'aser. And that's where the Mishnah says you can tilt the barrel over in order to get the stone off. But if I put the stone on deliberately on the barrel, so now the barrel becomes a basis of davar ha'aser, and the barrel becomes mukso. So this is said over by Rabbi Ami. And now Rabbi Yosef Amar, Rabbi Asi Amar, Rabbi Yochanan. So now this in the differing position of Rabbi Yosef, who says in Rabbi Asi, who says in Rabbi Yochanan. And again, we're going to focus on the name of Asi over here because it all goes back to Rabbi Yochanan. Now Rabbi Yochanan either took one of these two positions, so we're assuming that really it is not a stira, but two different mesoras in terms of what Rabbi Yochanan said. And it could also very well be that Rabbi Yochanan himself may have changed his mind on the matter anyway. Rav Asi says, Lo shanu l'b'shecheh. Yes, it's true. The case of the Mishnah where you can tilt the barrel over in order to have the stone fall off the side of the barrel, that's where if you forgot it there, aval b'meiniach. But if you put it there intentionally, na'aseh kisui la'achavis. Now what it does is it becomes part and parcel of the lid, meaning the stone was placed over there basically to solidify, to put more weight on the lid, meaning perhaps you wanted to make sure that there was a more secure covering, you want to put more weight on, and so you put the stone over there by intention, on purpose, so that the stone now becomes part and parcel of the lid, and just the opposite. Meaning, it's not that the barrel becomes muksa, it's not that the stone becomes non-muksa, because you clearly put it over there because you wanted the stone over there. So over here now, the debate between Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi is what happens when you put on the stone intentionally. If you forgot the stone on top of it, so now everyone's in agreement. That's the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, now you just simply tilt the barrel over, allow the stone to fall off on its own, that's tilt on its side, and now you can take the barrel. But what happens when I put the stone on intentionally? If I put the stone on intentionally, according to Rabbi Ami, the stone is muksa, the barrel is a basa, so davar aser. And meanwhile, according to Rav Asi, just the opposite. If I put the stone on intentionally, it means that I wanted the stone there to begin with, and that means to say now that the stone is incorporated as part of the barrel, and now the stone and the barrel are mukhan. They're all non-muksa items. And so what we have over here is a really interesting debate in terms of what do you have to do with the stone in order to remove its muksa status from it. Amar Rabba, so before we investigate that point a little bit more in some better detail, the Gemara now notes, Amar Rabba Mosvina Shmaitin. So Rabba says, you know, my position, that's Rabbi Ami's position, so it's a little bit difficult based on the Mishnah that we just learned. I haven't should be curious of Ima Malamba, Veinu Nofels Memalamba. Let's take a look at our Mishnah. Our Mishnah also talks about a stone, the stone that was put into the shell, and the stone that's put into the shell, only if it's tied into the shell under those circumstances, as long as the stone doesn't fall out, so you can go ahead and you can use the shell. And what he thinks now is, wait one second, we just saw in our Mishnah a case in which the stone loses its muksa status. Now that seems to go against his position, because his position is that a stone does not lose its muksa status. So Velohi, but the Gemara says that the comparison is not a good comparison. Hasam kevin dahat kash avyan dofen. Now in the case of the melon, you're tying the stone to the melon. Since you're tying the stone to the melon, so basically you're incorporating the stone as part of the melon. In the case of the barrel, you're just simply putting the stone on the barrel. It's not the same case. Amar Rav Yosef umas min hashmaitin. Now Rav Yosef says, now it's interesting because remember, he is espousing Rav Asi's viewpoint. Rav Asi is espousing his viewpoint, whichever. And he says, look, let's take a look back at our Mishnah. Im lav ein memalam ba. Now, if the stone is not tied into the melon, so then the stone is muksa. So that would seem to indicate that if the stone was just put into the shell of the melon, the stone is still going to retain its muksa status. So isn't that mean now that if I put the stone on the barrel, the stone is going to retain its muksa status, and that would be difficult for his position? Velohi, but the Gemara says, even within Rav Yosef, it's not going to be a question. Hasum came into Lohatka bituli batla. So he says, no, because over there in the case of the shell, you had a chance of tying it into the shell. You didn't tie into the shell. So clearly the stone was never meant to be moved from its original status of being a regular stone. And so therefore you never took away the muksa status of the stone. Meanwhile, in the case of the barrel, when you're putting the stone on the lid of the barrel and you don't have to tie it over there, meaning the weight of the stone is enough to secure the lid over the barrel. So then, as far as you're concerned, that's what you wanted. And so therefore the stone is in fact going to lose its muksa status. Now with all that stated, so what we have over here is a basic machlokas between Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, what you have to do to a stone in order to remove its muksa status. Meaning taking a stone and putting it on the lid of a barrel, by intention, doing that before Shabbos, is that going to remove the status of muksa from the stone? Rabbi Ami says it will not. The stone remains muksa. The barrel underneath this is a basis of davar aser. Rav Asi, on the other hand, says no, that the stone loses its status by being muksa. Just by you putting it on the lid of the barrel is enough to make it lose its status. B'maika miflgi. And now within this machlokas, the Gemara gives the following. Mar sav rabbi nemaisa, mar sav lo bin nemaisa. When it comes to something like a stone, where its very nature is that it's muksa. Remember what we learned in the Gemara just the other day. And that is that if something's not a kli, like a stone, so its default setting is going to be that it's muksa. Now what you can do is you can take it and say, look, I know a stone is muksa, but I need it this Shabbos. It serves a purpose to me. What do I have to do in order to remove the default setting of the muksa status of a stone? And so what the Gemara now is contending is that really the machlokas is that what needs to be done to change settings of the muksa status of a stone? Do you have to do a full-fledged action, or is it just simply enough to just make a designation, a mental designation? And the Gemara says now, it proves to be that Rabbi Ami and Rav Asi are consistent in this regard. Because the Gemara gives the following scenario, Pamachas, Halach Rabbi Lamakom Echad, Rabbi went to a town. Now what he found over there was a pile of stones. Now these stones were piled up, which give an indication that these stones were meant for construction. Now before Shabbos, Rebbe gives the following instructions to his students. So he says to the students, look, let's just simply set in our minds that these stones are going to be used tomorrow, meaning the stones are going to be sat on. But we don't have to do anything to the stones. We just simply need to think in our minds that the stones are in fact going to serve as a purpose. And so according to the first version, this is Rabbi Hanina's version, all we need to do is a machshava. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Hitzrichan Rabbi la Maisa. So Rabbi Yochanan says, no, Rabbi needs a Maisa. Now, it's critical over here is to realize that this is the sheet of Rabbi Yochanan. Now both Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi earlier in the Gemara are both quoting Rabbi Yochanan. And so now what we're going to see is that there are going to be two understandings of what Rabbi Yochanan meant, as you can guess correctly. One is going to be Rabbi Ami and one is going to be Rav Asi. And what we're going to find is that their positions are in fact going to be consistent with what we saw above. So Rabbi Yochanan Amar Yitzricha Rabbi LaMaisa, my Amar Lahu. Rabbi Yochanan says that Rabbi required a Maisa. Now what kind of Maisa did he need? So Rabbi Ami Amar, focus on the words Rabbi Ami. Rabbi Ami says, Se'uv Lindum Amar Lahu. Rabbi's instructions were to the students was, pick up the stones and set them down where everyone's going to sit. And this was before Shabbos. Meaning to say, you need to do a bona fide maisa. In order for a stone to lose its designation of muksa, in order to give it a muhan status for Shabbos, it must be picked up and manipulated. You have to actually pick the stones up. So that means to say that according to Rabbi Ami, you need to do a maisa. Now go back to what we started, putting the stone on the top of the lid. Now, it's true that you did, in fact, over there move the stone, but you didn't. All you did was just simply put the stone on top. I guess what the Gemara is arguing is that that's not enough of a movement. That part needs to be clarified a little bit better, but I guess that's the Gemara's thought process. But anyway, you need a maisa according to Rabbi Ami. And Rav Asi Amar Tzu V'Shif Shifum. Now, Rav Asi Amar Luhu. And Rav Asi says, no, the only thing that Rabbi told the students, according to Rabbi Yochanan, it's just simply, you know what, just clean off the stones from any dirt. I mean, you don't have to pick up the stones. You don't have to move the stones. Just make sure that tomorrow for Shabbos, the stones are going to be clean. So just, if there's any dirt on there, just wipe down the stones. it's Rashi describes it as a maisa kol dehu. In other words, it's barely in action. And so that means to say that according to Rabbi Asi, you don't have to do a significant action in order to remove the stones from its muksa status. You don't have to pick up the stones. You don't have to actually move the stones into place. Just simply a brushing of the stones is going to be enough. And so now what we see is consistency between Rabbi Ami and Rav Asi to what we saw above. When the stone is put on the top of the barrel, is the stone now going to lose its muksa status? Rabbi Ami says no. Rabbi Asi says yes. And now, basically, in this presentation, Rabbi Yochanan, in terms of what Rebbe told the students what to do with the stones, Rabbi Ami and Rav Asi are pretty much consistent with their positions that we saw above. Itmar Rabbi Yossi ben Shal Omer, Sura Shal Karos Hava. Now, there are going to be two other viewpoints of what exactly Rebbe had the students prepare before Shabbos. So the first version is that there was a pile of stones. According to Rabbi Yossi ben Shaul, it was a collection of boards or beams. Sura Shal Karos Hava. Rabbi Yochanan ben Shaul Amar, Gisho Shal Svina Hava. In a third version, what the students had over there was the poles that were used by the sailors. So we discussed this a little bit earlier in the Masechta, right? When the boats were going downstream, so the people at the front of the boat, they had these poles in order to test to see how deep the water is so that the boat doesn't capsize. So, manda amar geshosh kol shekein suar. Now, as far as the geshosh are concerned, those are significant. The geshosh are instruments that were very dear and precious to the sailors and to the boats. And if you're telling me that the geshosh can lose their status of being muksa, certainly the beams, which are not that significant, can lose the status of being muksa. Umanda amar suar, but if you're of the opinion that it was a pile of beams, have a geshosh kapit alayo, but as far as the prods were concerned that were used by the sailors, so those are, the way Rashi describes it, are muksa machmas chisar and kis. These are very valuable items. They're not going to be used for other items. This is something which is muksa according to everybody. Here Rashi points out, even Rabbi Shimon, right, as we pointed out in the beginning of Shir today, right, the machlokas between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon leisle muksa, Rabbi Yehuda isle muksa. Even Rabbi Shimon's position, who doesn't subscribe to muksa, doesn't mean he doesn't subscribe to muksa at all. It just simply means he has a very limited scope of muksa. Here, the poles that were used by the sailors, so that's muksa machlokas chisar and kis, even according to the sheet of Rabbi Shimon, that is going to qualify, that's going to be muksa. Anyway, so what Rabbi organized before Shabbos, either was a pile of stones, a pile of beams, or it was the rods that were used by the sailors. I'm not really sure how that's good for sitting on. Anyway, those are the possibilities. But what we gain from all this is that when it was assumed to be a pile of stones, what do you have to do to the pile of stones in order to remove its muksa status? We had an opinion of Rabbi Yochanan, and within Rabbi Yochanan, we had two opinions amongst the students, Rabbi Ami and Rav Asi. What did you need to do to the stones? Rav Ami says you had to actually manipulate and move the stones before Shabbos. According to Rav Asi, you just simply have to brush the stones down. And so, to remove the muksa status of the stones, do you need a maisa? Do you need a bona fide action like Rabbi Ami? Or do you not need such a maisa? That would be the position of Rav Asi. And that goes back then to the machlokas of what happens when you put a stone on the lid before Shabbos. Is that going to remove the muksa status of a stone? Rabbi Ami would say no. Rabbi Asi would say yes. Let's do just a little bit more. Let's go to the next section. Umo deshik shura v'chule. We're now talking about tying the vine to the jug so that I could lower the jug into the well. Kshura in lo kshura lo. Now, only if the vine is tied to the jug. But if it's not, then you can't move it. Lema masisin loka Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Now, assuming that this inference is a good inference, it's a very clear inference of the Mishnah, the problem with that is then that our Mishnah is not going to be subscribing to the viewpoint of Rav Shimon Gamliel, Ditanya, because we have the following braisa. Chav Yosha Dako Shigadron Leitzim. Let's say I had a reeds of the palm tree. Wood of the palm tree. It was cut up as firewood. And then Benim Lechaleim LeYeshiva. And then what happens is that you change your mind and you plan on using this firewood, not as firewood, but now you're going to use it as makeshift chairs. Sarach likshur. So in order to be able to sit on them for Shabbos, in order for them to lose their muksa status, so they need to be tied. Rabbi Shimon, in other words, they need to be bundled together so that they actually can be sat on. And presumably also what the tying does is the tying is a maisa. In other words, it's an action that removes the muksa status because obviously just simply as wood blocks. So they are muksa. So once they're tied together, so you've done a maisa. And so therefore, you have now made it a non-muksa entity. Rav Shimon Gamliel, Omer, Ein Tzarach Likshur, and according to Rav Shimon Gamliel, you don't have to tie them up. Now, you see that according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, for something to lose its muksa status, so it doesn't have to be tied up. If that's true, which it is, I mean, that's Shitas Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, it seems to be that doesn't fit into our Mishnah. Because our Mishnah says that the movement of the vine can only be if you tied it to the jug. The inference of the Mishnah is pretty clear. If it wasn't tied to the jug, you can't move it. And so that would mean that our Mishnah is not following the Shita of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Okay, now, in of itself, it wouldn't be the end of the world. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is a Das Yachid. And the Tanakhama representing the majority position is going to be in line with our Mishnah. But can we make our Mishnah going even according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel? That's what the Gemara is going to try to do. Amar Sheshes Afilu Tamer Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Could be that our Mishnah is in fact following Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, the Hacha B'Maiskinan B'Mechuberes Ba'avya. So the Gemara says that maybe what we're discussing over here in our Mishnah is that the vines were still connected to the ground. So the Gemara says, what? The vines are still connected to the ground? So the vines, of course, are muksa. Ihachi kamishamish b'mechub l'karka. So the Gemara says, you know that the vines are connected to the ground, meaning they're connected to a tree, so now that's making use of a tree. You can't make use of a tree on Shabbos. So lemata migimel. So the Gemara proposes, yeah, but the vines over here under discussion are within three tefachim of the ground, right? We will see this when it comes to trees. A stump that is within three tefachim of the ground that's considered part and parcel of the ground. You could sit on a stump that's within three tefachim of the ground. The vines, if they are within three tefachim of the ground, also are considered part and parcel of the ground, and therefore they can be moved even if they're connected. Rav Ashi Amar, and that's what our Mishnah is describing, and so under those circumstances, so then those vines can be moved, but only if they're tied, right? If they're not tied, so then the concern would be that you're going to detach them from the tree itself. So the only way that you can use such vines is only if they are tied. But in general, the machlokas between Rav Shimon Gamliel and the Chachamim regarding the beams of wood, so you don't have this concern, you don't have this consideration. Fine. Rav Ashi Amar Afilu Tema B'Tlusha. And Rav Ashi says, no, a different way to respond, a different way to incorporate Rav Shimon Gamliel into our Mishnah. Meaning, when it comes to the wood doesn't need to be tied up. As long as you consider that these wood blocks are going to be sat on, that's enough. But meanwhile, in our Mishnah, why does it need to be tied up? Rav Ashi Amar Afilu Tema B'Tlusha. The vines over here could be detached from the ground. Gzera Shema Yiktom. But the problem is as follows, is that if these vines are not tied up prior to Shabbos, so what may end up happening is that you're going to find that these vines are not the right size, and what you might find yourself doing on Shabbos is cutting them down to size. Cutting them down to size, Rashi says, it's makeh bepatish. So if you are tempted to cut them down to size, thereby violating the malacha of makeh bepatish, so then even Rav Shimon Gamliel is going to be worried or concerned about such a scenario. Masha Enkin, when it comes to the blocks of wood, there's no need to cut them down to size. Meaning the blocks of wood are going to be able to be sat on regardless of what size they are. So that could be another difference between the cases of the blocks of wood and our Mishnah's case of the tying the vines to the jug. Okay, let's recap our daf. A lot of information brought down over the course of today's daf. We started with, first on the bottom of Kuch Avdalam and Aleph, we start with the halach of Rabbi Huna Mashmuel, where I have the lid of the barrel broke, but the lid's still intact. So the halacha is that the lid does not lose the status of being muksa. We have a brisa supporting that as well. What if the lid was thrown into the garbage? On Shabbos itself, it's not going to affect the status of the lid. If it was thrown into the garbage before Shabbos, so then the lid would in fact lose its status of being a kli. The Gemara talked about frayings of a mat, the loose ends of a mat that were frayed off. So they are still going to be considered usable on Shabbos because you could use them with the same purpose that you did with the mat. The mat is there to cover the earth and cover the ground. So the fraying part can also be used to cover it as well. This is not true, however, regarding the frayed parts of a talus. Frayed parts of a talus, if the frayed parts are smaller than gimel by gimel, so then they have no purpose whatsoever, and therefore they are in fact going to be muksa. The Gemara spent a good amount of the Amud Aleph of today's daf going over Shivrei Tanur with the broken pieces of an oven. Machlokes Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda. Rav Meir says that the broken pieces of an oven retain their status of being an oven and are usable on Shabbos. And Rav Yehuda says, no, it's no longer a kli, and therefore they can't be moved on Shabbos if they broke on Shabbos. And then the Eidus of Rav Yossi in the name of Rav Elazar ben Yaakov, one, paskin like Rav Meir, two, about the lids of an oven that don't need a handle. Going to the machlokas of Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda, what is that machlokas predicated on? So in the Amud Aleph today, we saw three different approaches amongst the Amoraim. Abaye says that it's consistent with the Machlokes of Rameir and Rav Yehuda of our Mishnah, of whether it's Ein Malacha, that's Rashita's Rameir, or Me'ein Malachtan, that's Rashita's Rav Yehuda. Rava gives a much more detailed presentation of the Machlokes. He's bothered by the fact that why are we just arguing about Tanur, or they should be arguing about Kelim in general. So Rava says, no, the Machlokes over here is about an oven, and a very specific oven, one where the heat is below the oven, and there is exhaust going out the sides, and so the oven is not being fully heated by the heat source underneath. Is that considered an oven? Rav Yehuda says no. The Chachamim say yes. And so what Rava presents is that's exactly what is being debated over here in our Mishnah. On that, Rav Ashi says it's very difficult because why then are we talking about the broken pieces of the oven? They're arguing about what the status of an oven is. So Rav Ashi doesn't like that pshat, but rather he goes back to our pshat. And it's really a chiddush in the shita of Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda says that in order for a shever kli to have the status of the kli, it has to be mei malachtan. But what we're learning within the Shita of Rav Yehuda is that it has to be not only Mei Malachtan, where the utility of the broken piece is going to be same as the actual Kli of itself, but in the same way. Meaning, because the tiles of the oven can be used as a griddle, but the fire then is going to be on the other side, external as opposed to internal, and it's going to be horizontal as opposed to vertical, that's enough of a change of utility where it's no longer considered Mei Malachtan according to Rav Yehuda. And finally, the last halacha of the Eidos of Rav Yossi in the name of Elazar ben Yaakov is in fact accepted la halacha. In Masa Mechasya, they take the lids of the oven, even though they don't have a handle, and they're relying on the sheet of Rav Elazar ben Yaakov. That was all side A. Side B of today's daf. So we went over a Mishnah with three halachas, and we really analyzed two of the three halachas. One, the stone that is knotted into the shell of a melon. That is there to add weight so that the melon can go into the water in order to collect the water, as long as it's tied into the melon. So the stone now becomes incorporated as part of the melon and therefore not moksa. Obviously it was tied in before Shabbos. If, however, the stone was just simply left in the oven, so then the stone is going to retain its status of moksa. And not only that, but the shell of the melon is going to be a basis of davar aser. The second halacha is tying the vine to the jug so that you can lower the jug into the ground. So as long as it's tied, it's good, it's fine. And the third halacha is the shutter, which we're going to be discussing in tomorrow's daf. On our Mishnah, so the Gemara discussed extensively, number one, the stone on the top of a barrel. So a Mishnah later in the Masechta is going to teach us that what you could do is you could tilt the barrel over, stone will fall off to the side, and now you could take the barrel. So the Amoraim all agree that's only in the case where you forgot the stone on top. But what if I place the stone specifically, purposely on top of the barrel? Is the stone going to retain its muksa status, or is it going to lose its muksa status? That's a machlokas between Rabbi Ami and Rav Asi. And the Gemara points out that Rabbi Ami and Rav Asi are consistent on this point in a number of different cases, where, in order to remove muksa status of a stone, do you need a maisa? Rabbi Ami says you need a maisa. And Rav Asi says, no, you don't need much of a maisa. You just simply have to have a designation. In the case of the stones in the pile, he wanted you to wipe down the stones, but you don't have to actually pick the stones up and move them to another location. And then we dealt with the second halacha of the Mishnah, where you had the vine connected to the jug, and if it's tied to the jug, then you could use it. So seemingly our Mishnah is not going like Rishim and Gamliel, because in a Mishnah that we're going to learn later on, in a Brisa that we're going to see later on, so Rishim and Gamliel and the Chachamim arguing over a bunch of logs that were left out, and they were originally set aside as firewood, and now we decided that we're going to use it now to sit on it. So according to the Tanakhama, they need to be tied together. And Rav Shem Gamliel says, no, they don't need to be tied together. So presumably our Mishnah is not going like Rav Shem Gamliel, and the Gemara gave two different approaches in terms of how it could be that our Mishnah is still even following the sheet of Rav Shem Gamliel, making a distinction between our Mishnah's case of the vine and the jug, and the Bryce's case of the logs.